Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On day one of our fall membership drive, during the program today, we'll ask you to stand up for independent journalism by volunteering to be not just a listener, but also a member of this non-commercial public radio station at this very intense time for truth and accountability in our world. Please check out our membership page at WNYC.org and see if membership is right for you. And we'll talk about it more later. Thanks so much for considering it. And we begin on a day when the United States and Canada are going in very different directions on drug policy. Yesterday, as maybe you heard, Canada became the largest country to begin national legal marijuana sales on a nationwide basis, while the Trump administration has been doubling down on a war on drugs that the Obama administration had begun to scale back. My first guest today is today's guest in our 30 Issues in 30 Days fall election series, Congressman Gerald Nadler of Brooklyn and Manhattan. This week on 30 Issues, we're looking at what might be different if Democrats win control. Congressman Nadler is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee and so is in line to likely be the next Judiciary Committee chairman. Drug enforcement and criminal justice generally are areas that the Judiciary Committee does oversight on. Thanks for joining this series, Congressman. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's good to be here.
First on marijuana policy specifically, we see what's going on in Canada. The Obama administration back in 2013 issued something called the Cole Letter to states that were legalizing marijuana at the state level, and Attorney General Sessions has rescinded the Cole Letter. Can you tell us what that was?
Well, basically, it was a letter, as I recall, that said that the federal government would not seek to impose its will on states that legalized marijuana, either for medicinal purposes or for recreational purposes also, and that the federal government would not try to enforce the law against the will of the people as expressed in the referendum, as a number of states have done, or through the legislature. And unfortunately, the Attorney General Sessions is going in the opposite direction. Look, from everything we know, the so-called war on drugs started by President Nixon has been an abject failure. It's thrown hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people into jail for no purpose at all. It has not succeeded in reducing crime or doing anything else. And we ought to look at drugs as a public health issue. At marijuana certainly is a public health issue. And that's what states are doing. And it seems to be far less damaging than nicotine to people's health. We should probably regulate it similarly.
Has Sessions just changed the official stance of the feds on legal pot states on paper, or is he actually enforcing federal marijuana laws ways that are putting people in prison?
I haven't seen that yet, but he's threatening to do that, and he could. I hope there will be pushback on that. Certainly parts of the Republican Party have been libertarian and have said that states should have their sway on these things, and they certainly should.
To your larger point about the war on drugs generally, I read a stat on Vox from drug policy expert Mark Kleiman of NYU, who's been a guest on this show many times, who said that in 1980, as the modern war on drugs was beginning, he pegged it to 1980, there were 15,000 Americans behind bars for drug dealing. Today, there are about 450,000, and yet the price, he says, of every major drug is even cheaper than it was then. Do you think that's a good way to measure the failure of the war on drugs?
Well, it's one way to measure the failure of the war on drugs. It certainly is a failure. If it were hard to get drugs, then the price would go up. I'm not sure that would be a good thing. It would probably mean more robberies and other crimes to support people's drug habits. But the fact is, from everything we have learned, people are going to do drugs. And certainly the softer drugs like marijuana, there is no good reason at all that they cannot be legalized and regulated properly. The war on drugs, the major effect of the war on drugs has been to fill our prisons with huge numbers of people to no great effect except to waste money and to ruin lives.
15,000 people in that category in 1980, the category of drug criminals behind bars, 450,000 today. And yet the era of mass incarceration generally is mostly a state-level thing, as most crimes are state, not federal. And if the law has overreacted and imprisoned too many people, it's largely from changes that were made in the 70s and 80s in state laws. What do you see as the federal government's role as member of Congress trying to end mass incarceration?
Well, the federal government led the way. I mean, yes, most people in jail because of the war on drugs or because of over-incarceration or in state jails. But the federal prison population, I forget the statistic, but zoomed by a factor of, I think, at least 10 or more. That's a great waste of people's lives. It's a great waste of the taxpayers' money, and it destroys lives, and it wastes our resources. Now, the federal government can do certain things. First of all, we ought to remove marijuana from the Schedule I. Marijuana is not could not be a Schedule I drug.
What does that mean, Schedule I?
I don't remember the legal definition, but it's a drug that under no circumstances can be used. That's mandatory enforcement, and it doesn't make any sense. But the federal government can do that, and the federal government ought to lead the way in changing our laws, which we are considering in Congress, and we ought to at least allow the states to liberalize their laws. We ought to liberalize the federal laws too, but at least allow the states to do it. The ending of mass incarceration has got to be both a state and a federal effort, and I think that can be done hand in hand.
In fairness to Sessions, Fox also reported that the total number of people in federal prisons fell during Trump's first year in office from 192,000 to 184,000. What should we make of that stat?
I don't know that I make much of it. That sounds like a variation around a similar number. I don't know of any major policy decisions that have been made that would lower the population. That could be just a variance around the mean.
My guest is New York City Congressman Gerald Nadler. Today's guest in our 30 Issues in 30 Days fall election series. No. This week, 30 Issues, looking at what might be different if Democrats win control of the House and or Senate. Congressman Nadler is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee.
I should add here, in fairness, that the House is considered and the Senate is considering criminal justice reform, which the Trump administration, certain versions of which the Trump administration is supporting. And I didn't vote for that bill because I didn't think it did certain things that we need to do. I hope it goes further when it comes from the Senate.
What bill is that?
The criminal justice reform. It'll do things like, or hopefully the final version will do things like, and hopefully we'll pass the final version this year, and if not this year, then next year. We'll do things like allow for rehabilitated prisoners to earn much more good time off to get out, to provide proper training for prisoners so they can reintegrate into society, and we'll have major, which we don't have in the current bill, we should have major sentencing reform, retroactive sentencing reform, because people who were sentenced under mandatory minimum sentences, which I'd like to get rid of, for very long mandatory sentences that you wouldn't even give today, that were sentenced 20 years ago to 40 years in prison, we ought to eliminate those mandatory minimums that judges often find unfair but tie their hands, and we ought to be able to take the sentencing changes that we have made and that we will make and make them available not just to future people who are convicted, but to people who were convicted years ago, so that someone who today would get a 5-year sentence but was sentenced to 35 years 20 years ago doesn't have to stay in prison another 15 years.
Where's the common ground you were referring to between you and the Trump administration on criminal justice reform? Can you get specific on some provisions?
There are the basic provisions on rehabilitation, on getting a good credit for learning, providing means of learning how to a trade in prison or whatever. There's general agreement on that approach. There seems to be agreement on time off for achieving such things. The sentencing reduction and the retroactivity, that's the biggest hang up.
Another big change under Trump and Sessions has to do with federal oversight of local police departments. Trump, in a speech just the other day, I'm sure you heard it, promoted the fact that he's from New York City, where the use of large-scale stop and frisk, like is no longer done here in New York, was effective in his telling in reducing crime. We know the crime has continued to go down under the de Blasio administration, even without mass stop and frisk. Do you see that as representing a larger change, that is Trump's language there, under Trump and Jeff Sessions with respect to oversight of local police departments?
No, I think that Trump is saying there exactly the opposite of what he ought to be saying. As you pointed out, stop and frisk was a terrible thing. It was, especially the way it was used, which is basically to stop and frisk minority youth, so that it was a rite of passage, whether they were doing anything wrong or not. It was an invasion of personal liberty, an invasion of personal dignity. And it was done, like I think it was 950,000 stops a year at one point at the height. And it was justified by saying, well, we've gotten guns off the street, et cetera, even though the percentage of stops that resulted in finding a gun was something like 0.2%, which means that 99.8% of the stops were useless. But this was justified as getting the guns off the street and reducing crime. And yet we had a federal court order back in 2013 saying you got to knock this off. And the de Blasio administration was elected on a pledge, among other things, of stopping this. And stop and frisk declined within the next year and a half by 94-95%. But the crime rate still continued to go down. The Daily News, to its credit, the Daily News editorialized very strongly against eliminating stop and frisk or reducing stop and frisk because it viewed it as essential to reducing crime. And it editorialized about a week ago, to its credit, and several times before that quote, we were wrong. The evidence has now shown conclusively the crimes continue to go down despite the almost total elimination of stop and frisk, except in extreme circumstances, and we shouldn't do it again. The president comes along and says, well, they got a problem in Chicago, so they ought to do in Chicago what obviously was a terrible imposition on liberty in New York and didn't work.
Another change from the Obama years was that Obama placed limits on how much local police could use civil asset forfeiture, that is taking people's property even without charging them with a crime. Sessions has made that easier again. What's the issue there? Why is property ever seized by the government if a person is not charged with a crime?
Well, it generally shouldn't be. There's a legal theory that under certain circumstances, the crime was committed by the property, not by the owner. The crime itself, the property itself committed the crime, and therefore can be forfeited.
That like corporations being citizens under the law?
It's as fictitious. It's as fictitious. It has different effects. So there, under various circumstances, you can seize property. And under certain circumstances, you can seize property as instrumentalities of the crime or results of the crime, and then you don't prove the crime. And that is wrong. It's especially wrong when you seize someone's assets and you therefore can't afford a defense attorney because you've seized the money. Hmm. And it may turn out to be perfectly legal money. There is a great, on the Judiciary Committee, on a bipartisan basis, there's a lot of skepticism about forfeiture, and it's something we've looked into, and certainly I think we're going to crack down on a lot more.
And one more, as we continue to catalog the differences in this area between Obama and Trump and how it might change back or might not. Another example, after the controversial police response in Ferguson, Missouri, the Obama administration had restricted how much local police departments could obtain military-style weapons like mm-hmm. sniper rifles and armored vehicles. But Trump signed an executive order making that easier to do again. What's your position on that, and what role could the Judiciary Committee play?
Well, I agree with the Obama administration position and not with the Trump administration position. That's not terribly surprising. Police should, what we have discovered in well-run police departments, such as New York is now and where it's been effective, is police are effective when they work with the communities, when they are trusted by the communities they are policing. And after all, they are policing for the benefit of those communities. If they are seen as a foreign occupying army and they travel and they go around in tanks, what do you need a tank for in normal circumstances? In policing, then they're not going to. People aren't going to come forward with information. They're not going to cooperate with them, and it's going to be much less effective. And you're going to have more hostility and friction, and probably more innocent people either arrested or in some cases killed, because you're going to have more nervous and fearful police officers. So it doesn't make any sense at all, and that's what we have found. So we should be curtailing military equipment to police to a very, very great extent, and we should be encouraging community policing. And we have found in places where you encourage community policing that it works, that crime goes down, and the community relies more and trusts more in the police department.
Congressman Gerald Nadler, ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee. His district is in Manhattan and Brooklyn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a prominent Republican in Congress, Senator Ben Sasse. Stay with us.